Our guest is Roy Guttman, foreign correspondent for the McClatchy newspaper chain, a Pulitzer Prize winner for his outstanding coverage of the war in Bosnia in 1993. The award, the coverage started, though, way back in the early days in 92. Roy, for the past year or more, has been spending an inordinate amount of time in Syria and Turkey, two of the most conflicted and most important countries in the world these days. Roy, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here, Darren.
Well, let's start with Syria. The big event of the past week or so was one of those scenes that's emblematic of our modern age, which is to say the peaceful withdrawal of opposition forces in Syria from the ancient city of Homs, escorted out of town by the UN and allowed to relocate to fight another place another day in northern Syria. First off, give us a sense of what was the military and political significance of the surrender of Homs.
Well, the city's been under siege for 2 years, the old town. The situation inside the besieged area has been probably close to intolerable and inhuman. Various organizations, including the Syrian Red Crescent, have tried to send in food and medicines, and the International Committee of the Red Cross. And often their people would get shot at, and I think in at least one case they were killed. So it's been a completely isolated location for people who are from Homs and who basically wanted to stay in their own town and not let the regime tell them what to do. Time and supplies and their whole living conditions just basically ran out. They didn't have a lot of choice but to surrender. And what strikes me is that, of course, they're treating this as a terrible setback for the rebellion. But, sieges can't go on forever. And especially if you're totally surrounded and, living in basically in caves and in tunnels and ducking for cover all the time. So the fact that they were allowed to go to central Syria in a way is it's a pretty honorable retreat, it seems to me. And I'm amazed, frankly, that it came off as smoothly as it did because the negotiations went back to, I think it was November last year in Geneva. And there was, so there were so many glitches in the past 6 months that it's astonishing that they got out, and they got out alive.
Now, Homs is the third largest city in Syria after Aleppo and Damascus. But in terms of sort of the strategic level of the survival of the awful presidency of Bashar al-Assad, does losing Homs change things in any strategic way?
I'm not sure if you can talk of a strategic loss when you're dealing there with a besieged enclave. strikes me, and this happens, I talk to Syrians pretty often, and this past week I was actually in Syria in the northern part for a day, and I talk to Syrians in the country and out of the country, and for example, just walking up to a man sitting on the ground outside the bus terminal in Kilis, just outside of the Syrian border. And I find it amazing, almost astonishing, that every person I talk to, when I ask them, do you have regrets? Do you think that the rebellion is wrong? Do you think that the so-called Free Syrian Army really should just pack up its goods and go home? What I hear from almost everybody is, we want to get rid of Assad. And this war is going to go on until then, and we hate it, and we want it to end, and it's abominable, but he has to go. So I don't think that, in a sense, that the evacuation of the besieged old town it changes really anything. I think, you know, at the end of the day, a rebellion like the Syrian one, which is really a national uprising that Assad then turned into an armed battle, and it depends on the people. It depends on the population and the average person. You know, when you go up to somebody who you don't know, who you're not being introduced to, and you're just asking their view, and they are passionate in their responses. So I don't think Assad has really gained that much.
You can already hear why I think Roy Guttman is the greatest foreign correspondent from America of our generation, because although he's covered a lot of wars, unlike some so-called war correspondents, he doesn't see them as the general sand pit with strategic points and tactical vectors moving across. For Roy, it's all about the people, which is what I have always believed. And I guess in a way, the significance to me of the retreat from Homs, which involved not just troops of the opposition, but their families and, in many cases, their extended families or just civilians from Homs who would have been identified as opponents of the Assad regime and therefore very insecure in a city controlled by the government. And they are all joining hundreds of thousands of what are called IDPs, meaning internally displaced persons, people who are refugees within their own country. And I would guess that the Syrian human landscape is now absolutely dominated by all of these internally displaced people.
Well, it's David, you're quite right. It's a it's something that's almost indescribable. I mean, Americans, I think, would have a hard time imagining that. Just imagine, half your country are either refugees in a foreign land, or internally displaced. That's to say, homeless, forced to take hospitality from relatives or friends or strangers, or to go into camps, which have been set up, especially on the northern border with Turkey, all over the place. There's just a countless number of camps. And, leaving your home is something most of us never want to imagine doing, you know, under the gun. Leaving behind all your possessions. But then it's also leaving behind your means of employment, your income, your resources. If you're a farmer, your animals and equipment and farm buildings and land, and I was giving up your life basically because you are fearing either artillery attack on your village or your town, or barrel bombs, these sort of cobbled together oil barrels full of shrapnel and explosives that they drop from great heights from helicopters. And they can destroy a house from the explosion and from the as well as the impact. But leaving everything behind out of fear, and that really is the picture of Syria today. The UN puts out. I hate to use numbers, but numbers do matter. But of the 22 million Syrians, the UN says there's about 9.5 million who are either external refugees or internally displaced, that is to say, homeless. But I think the number is higher than that, because I know that they've been underestimating the internally displaced for more than a year and a half, in fact. And so it's the landscape in the north of Syria is something frightening to behold, because, people set up a camp. Hopefully you set it up in a place where the land will dry quickly if there's a rain. But without adequate protection from the elements, without adequate, without electricity, sometimes even without water resources. And then the whole question is, how do you feed these people? How do you take care of the trash? And how do you take care of the sanitation? And the picture there is, I think, one of the most awful anywhere on earth.
You know, it's the great blessing of America that since 1865, the continental United States has never been a theater of war. Conversely, of course, our profound ignorance of what war really means may make it politically easier for us to promulgate war elsewhere because American voters literally don't know what they are creating when they do this. Roy, you spent some time in a town called Khan Shukrun, which normally has a population of about 80,000, which would make it almost exactly the same size as Santa Fe. But these are not normal times. What are things like, what is life like in a city like Khan Shukrun that now has, what, at least as many refugees as residents?
Well, one correction, David. I didn't actually go there. And I don't think one actually can go there as a foreign correspondent. You can go anywhere, but you take your life in your hands. And the fact is, most of the people of Khan Shukrun have left. It is a town of, as you say rightly, about 80,000 population, but it was swollen to twice that size by the internally displaced, by the internal refugees. And then about 3 months ago, rebel forces tried to close the highway that goes past Khan Shukrun, that goes between Damascus, which is the capital, and Aleppo, the biggest city. And I think the rebels have tried to do this now for a couple of years, but they didn't have the right weapons, and they weren't able to stop the army from crashing through again. This year, something changed. They acquired more anti-tank weapons. And so every time the government would send a tank convoy up the road, and probably firing in all directions, the rebels figured out ways to trap it. And they claimed to have killed an incredible number of tanks. I couldn't prove it, but they say 40 to 50, which is a huge number. I was able to find YouTube and social media evidence that they killed at least a dozen, maybe 20, in fact. But in any case, in response to the loss of control of the road, the Assad regime did something that it does customarily. It doesn't really have enough ground troops and infantry, dismounted infantry, to break through a rebel blockade or a rebel ambush. But what it does have is air power. And it uses air power in a very devastating way, it doesn't usually direct it, from everything I know, against the rebel forces, although it sometimes does, of course, sometimes hits them. But on the whole, what it does, what they do is they punish the civilians in the towns all along the road, as if every one of them is supporting the rebel force, and as if they can punish them at will, and in fact arbitrarily. So they started dropping barrel bombs on Khan Shukrun about 3 months ago. And on another city nearby, Kafr Zeta, they were dropping not only barrel bombs, but also barrel bombs containing chlorine. And I've heard so many stories, and I've run into so many people who've described it, that I have no doubt about it. And I think there's now some international expertise that's proven that it's true. It's not that chlorine bombs are a chemical weapon as such, killing everybody on impact like sarin does, but it causes immense distress and all sorts of health problems, and especially for infants and for small children and the very old. And in any case, the onslaught of these barrel bombs plus air attacks and also artillery drove people in Khan Shukrun out. And so now, I talked to a family about a week ago who had just come the day before from Khan Shukrun. They said that there might be 5,000 people in the town, and they're all waiting to leave. They all want to come to either to Turkey, which is where I interviewed this family, or to one of the camps along the border. The problem is most of them have no money. They may have just enough money to pay for the bus or the little jitney bus taking them to the border. But how are they going to live in the camps when you have to buy a tent in these camps? They're so rare. And to live in Turkey, you know, on the economy, the Turks are very generous. They have really opened their borders in a very humanitarian way to fleeing Syrians. But they're not subsidizing people. You know, they don't go into welfare when they get here. They're broke, and they have to rely on the kindness of relatives, friends, strangers, or basically they sleep in the streets. So that's why people are still there, but there are very few, David.
Now, barrel bombs, and for that matter, barrel bombs reinforced by chlorine, are perfect examples of completely indiscriminate weapons. They are not precisely targetable. They disperse their effects widely. And when chlorine is added to the mix, they become a consummate terror weapon because when you're choking and gasping, it's hard for you to say, oh, this is chlorine, not sarin. I'd be dead by now if it were sarin. No, you feel like you are being chemically attacked, and the terror that this spreads simply can't be exaggerated.
Well, you're right. I talked to one young man. He was about 20, from the Kafr Zeta, and that's in that same area where the chlorine bombs had been dropped. He described the scene. He said he was pretty close to the area, but he was able to go into the fresh air and breathe, and the effect wore off quickly. But he came upon two infants, one who was, I think, a year and a half old, the other which was 6 months old, and they were both badly affected by it. He brought both of them to the hospital, and they could have been treated with oxygen, except for one thing, which is the hospital had run out of oxygen. You know, they were descended upon by 100 people who were all showing the same symptoms of acute distress. And they tried to expose the infants to the fresh air. It wasn't enough, and they were both dead. And so, you know, I think that this happens again and again. We don't even know a quarter of the stories. We don't know a tenth of the stories because, frankly, reporters have to go inside of Syria, and it's quite tricky to go there. And it's especially tricky to go to a place like Kafr Zeta, or any place that's under barrel bombing. And so most of my colleagues, and including myself, you know, have been extremely cautious these last months. My trip in was basically to the northern border area, and there I felt like I was relatively safe because it's within the Turkish airspace. Well, it's within 5 miles of the Turkish airspace, and the Turks basically don't let the Syrians get anywhere close to Turkish airspace. But anyway, chlorine bombs are the latest weapon, and there's something that I guess we haven't seen since maybe World War I. I don't know, you know, what exactly Assad has in mind in dropping them, except to terrorize the population and to depopulate it. And quite frankly, this is what's happened throughout most of northern Syria: is that any town which is held by where the government is not in control is thought to be held by the resistance, by the rebels, is a target.
Roy, about 9 months ago, when President Obama was considering military intervention in Syria, he first emphatically ruled out boots on the ground forces entering Syria, and then eventually decided against bombing Syria, again, largely because of the fear of creating collateral damage, untargeted human fatalities. But with the Syrian government forces, as you point out, so completely dependent on air power, isn't there or might there be an option for a no-fly zone, an air cap, which would put a real crimp in Assad's survival plans without necessarily causing the kinds of collateral damage or the kinds of losses to Americans that either real bombing or ground forces entering Syria would result in?
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with your premise. I think you're right that a no-fly zone would be an enormous protection. Listen, let's face it, it's not my country, it's not my politics. How things come out there is really going to be up to Syrians. what concerns me, and what I think should concern all of us, especially foreign observers, especially journalists, especially Americans, is that you know, you have civilians being targeted deliberately, and the cities being bombed and destroyed, even refugee camps up until the Turks began to assert their own air defense over parts of Syria. Even refugee camps were targeted by the government forces. It seems to me that this is really a terrible blot on everybody. It should be on everybody's conscience that civilians are being targeted and are being killed right, left, and center every day in multiple parts of Syria. I don't think, but accepting your premise as a plausible one, I have to say I don't think it's even necessary for the U.S. to establish a no-fly zone. I don't think you even need an outside power. What you need, what the Syrian rebel forces say they need, and not just they, but really all the civilians, it's sort of on everybody's lips there, is they need air defense. What they need is just simply the ability to shoot down and stop the helicopters from dropping barrel bombs and the aircraft from firing missiles. And all this takes is fairly unsophisticated but and available equipment that that the U.S. has up until now steadfastly refused to deliver. And so basically everybody is vulnerable from air attacks by either barrel bombs or aircraft. So that is a much simpler thing, and that's in the hands of, that would be in the hands of Syria. You wouldn't need any boots on the ground. You wouldn't even need the U.S. to fly some kind of a cap over Syria.
My guest on the Radio Cafe this morning is Roy Guttman, Pulitzer Prize-winning foreign correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. I'm Dave Marish, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. The rationale from Washington for not supplying shoulder-fired missiles, man pads, they're often called, that might also defend people on the ground against Assad's attacks from the air, is there's a fear that those weapons could fall into the hands of the al-Qaeda-related elements within the Syrian opposition and might be used against civilian airplanes or for terrorist reasons rather than within the confines of the Syrian civil war. Roy, you've been reporting that there's been a dramatic shift and that the relative strength of the al-Qaeda elements of the opposition may be declining seriously in Syria. Fill us in on that.
There are two elements that you could call extreme jihadis or Islamic extremists, one of which is foreign-based, and that's the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, or Iraq and Syria, some people call it. And the other is the Nusra Front, which is domestically based. Now, the first one, the Iraqi state, is actually based in northern Iraq, in the Sunni areas there, and is a very mysterious force. They only came to light in Syria as such just a little over a year ago. They announced their presence. They announced they would be the force, the jihadi force. It basically were a breakaway from the Nusra Front, which is a domestically based force that has allied itself with al-Qaeda. And so the Iraqi state forces started taking enormous amounts of territory in the north starting last April, a year ago. And they closed off many of the border crossings. They started threatening journalists, and they captured a lot of journalists, maybe 30 journalists, in fact, and they hold them for ransom. They started capturing members of the Free Syrian Army, which is the pro-Western force trying to assault Assad. And then they even started fighting at a certain point with the Nusra Front, who were their ostensible allies in al-Qaeda. This Iraqi front got so stroppy, in a way, that that al-Qaeda ordered them to quit al-Qaeda. I mean, Zawahiri, who's, I think, operates out of Pakistan or somewhere, announced that that the Iraqi front is no longer even part of al-Qaeda. Nusra is. What's happened in, it started in January, and it started in a town called al-Atarib in northern Syria, is that some commanders, and they have a fairly loose affiliation with the Free Syria, and they don't get much supplies from them. They don't really get much direction from them. They don't get much intelligence from them. They don't get anything from them. But they do have an identity with the Free Syrian Army, as, which itself has an identity with the exile politicians. And the identity is that they believe in a secular state, and they want they say they want a democratic state, and they say they want a modern state, and you know, and they don't have a religious goal as such. So members of this Free Syrian Army, and it was called the Revolutionary Front, and a man named Jamal Maarouf was just took the lead in it. He started attacking the Islamic State people. And they had taken over the town of al-Atarib. They were holding executions in the main square. And he told his men, and he got together an alliance of 20 or 30 different, he got clerics, he also got military leaders, he got civic leaders. He said, look, our time is up. If we don't attack them now, they're gonna destroy us. And they did attack in January, and they basically ousted the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria from much of, maybe a third to a half of the north of Iraq, of Syria. The Islamic State people still control one whole province. But the odd thing is, David, and this is really a story I'm still working on, the odd thing is that they seem to be working in kind of collusion with the government of Syria. Because when they take over, first of all, when they run, when they were running al-Atarib, for example, they were operating out of the city hall, and they put up their black flag, and you know, you would think that that would be an invitation to the Syrian Air Force to come and bomb them, because they, you know, this is supposed to be government territory. But in fact, they never got bombed. In fact, they never do get bombed by the Syrian government. Only when Maarouf's people forced them out of al-Atarib, did al-Atarib come under attack again. And now it gets barrel bombs every day, and so many people have been killed in al-Atarib. It's shocking, because it's not a strategic point at all for the Syrian government. But in any case, so that was the reversal. It happened in January. There's still a lot of unfinished business for the Free Syrian Army and for the Islamic groups, by the way, because after a while, the Islamic State people became so extreme and so full of themselves and so criminal in their activities, and you know, kidnappings. They set up jails all over the place, tortured people, killed people in jails, stole their property, and so on. They became so nefarious that and so unpopular with the Syrian population, that the Islamic fighting groups, including Nusra, started fighting them. And that's the story today. There have been truces. There have been temporary slowdowns in the fighting, but it continues. This group is truly dangerous, because they not only control parts of Syria where, you know, with a devastating effect on civilians, but they also extend their power into northern Iraq, and they're controlling Fallujah and other towns there now, and they basically are a force that seems to be pretty steady and stable in its means of support. They've taken the oil wells in Syria, and that's one of their means of income, and the other is taking journalists and others and selling them for ransom. So that group is still there. But I would think in the next few months we will see another offensive by the Free Syrian Army to force them out of Syria.
Now, of course, the marginalization of the ISIS and their denunciation by al-Qaeda central to the degree that such a thing exists, still leaves the al-Nusra Front, which, as you say, has genuine Syrian roots, but also has the al-Qaeda affiliation and a heavily jihadi Islamist orientation. How powerful are they among the constellation of groups that form the Syrian opposition?
You know, it ebbs and flows. And it does because, really, with what they accomplish and what they stand for. If they act like terrorists then terrorize the population, which they did in some towns. I visited one town last summer called Al-Shadida in northern Hasaka province. And frankly, locals came up to us and told us how awful these people were, the way they were running this town of Al-Shadadi. And this is an oil-producing town. And they really made pests of themselves when they took over. But it turns out that they're nothing so bad as ISIS. And, so now they're fighting for that very town and for Deir al-Zour, another town that I stayed in, against ISIS is fighting Nusra. I think that Nusra, one of my colleagues at McClatchy was actually detained by Nusra for a whole day, along with an interpreter, and it was not nice. But they do not do things like the ISIS do. The question we all have, David, and I don't think we really know the answer, is who really are the Nusra front? Many of their leaders were held in jails by Assad and subsequently freed at the beginning of the rebellion in 2011, and then founded Nusra in less than a year after the rebellion began in March of 2011. And one of the questions people have is, are they really anti-Assad? Because they, on the whole, they really do fight Assad. Or are they people whom he can influence because he knows the Mukhabarat, the secret police, know their stories and know their pressure points and know how to make them do things. We don't really know. What is clear is that ISIS is really a dangerous force, and Nusra, so far as we can tell at this moment, is probably much more domestically inclined, much more anti-Assad. When you go to people on the street and you ask them, and I have to just take these random interviews. I mean, here's an example. I went into a camp just about a week ago, and met an imam who was from central Syria, and I asked him, what about these extremists? And the response I was really quite moved by, because again, this is a random interview. Nobody set it up and nobody prepared. And he says, "We Syrians are not extremists. We are not jihadis. We do not believe in an ethnic struggle. We do not believe that this is a civil war. They believe this is an uprising against the government." And he said, you can be sure when this war in Syria comes to an end, we will go back to our homes, and this will not become a state of terror. But he said, why do you Westerners, Americans and Europeans, why don't you listen to us, and why don't you support us? Because what we want is a state like your state. And I found that very telling, and I keep on hearing it, that all of the claims of the Islamic groups notwithstanding, all of the gains of the extremists like ISIS notwithstanding, there are normal people in that country who want a normal life, and the manifestations you have in a conflict of extremists, and this is really not the only conflict you or I, David, have covered, where you find extremists popping up and claiming great goals and great leadership and then turning out to be so much hot air. But all that notwithstanding, Syria is a country of people who are not extremists. And these manifestations, they may not end completely when and if the war ends, but they are really not the dominant factor.
Our guest is Roy Guttman, foreign correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. Roy is presently in Turkey and has spent a lot of time over the last 18 months inside Syria as well. Roy, I have to ask you about a story that was published in the London Review of Books and has not gotten a lot of play in the United States. It was authored by Seymour Hersh, one of the premier investigative reporters in American journalism, and among its major points was that the infamous chemical attack that crossed everybody's red lines about a year ago was not the work of the Assad regime, but actually was the work of Al-Qaeda link, probably ISIS opposition figures, and that they had gotten all of the precursors for chemical weapons with the aid of the Erdogan government in Turkey. Do you have an opinion on Sy's story?
Well, I hate to be to give you a snap judgment, but I think it's pretty preposterous. And I say that because you not only have to prove that the Assad government didn't have chemical weapons and was not prepared to use them, which is something that's easy to disprove. They have used them in other places, and major governments know that, and they also had the means of delivery. Secondly, you have to prove that the opposition forces, or the extremist opposition forces, not only had chemical weapons, but also means of delivery in order to attack their own people. I mean, this comes straight out of the Balkan Wars, where when there was a massacre of people with shells attacking the marketplace in Sarajevo, Milosevic in Serbia and Karadzic, his agent in Bosnia, would claim that the Bosnian Muslims had fired these missiles at themselves in order to kill their own people and win sympathy. And, you know, that's the big lie. Hersh has some interesting details in his story. I read it carefully, but this is a case where he really fails to prove, I think, almost even any single element of it. There is clearly no evidence that the opposition. There's one opposition force which actually may have a tie with the regime, which claims to have had some chemical weapons about a year and a half ago. But it is not any of the main opposition forces, and as I say, it's one that's very suspect because the leader was a person who was held in Assad's prisons and who seemed to be playing footsie with Assad at different points in the fighting. But there's a very big gap between pretending to have such weapons or access to such weapons and actually using them in a way that kills hundreds and hundreds of people effectively. The second thing is my contention is that if some force or other than the Syrian government had those weapons, they would have come from the Syrian government. The second element is that Hersh claims, on a basis of the thinnest of data, that the Erdogan government in Turkey facilitated the acquisition of chemical weapons. And to give them to extremists. I mean, the Erdogan government is an Islamist government in a sense. That it supports Islam and it wants more of an Islamic nature to Turkey. You know that they won elections fair and square, and that's their agenda, and they're doing what they said they would do. But it is by no means an extremist government. It is so far from reality to think that they are actually in cahoots with Islamist extremists and giving them weapons of mass destruction to be used against civilians opposed to the Erdogan government. Well, this is bizarre because, frankly, the Erdogan government, which has many faults in many areas, has done, a really noble thing in supporting Syrians, millions of them, more than a million of them here in this country, and in Syria, and has been very principled in its opposition to Assad throughout. So the idea that they would be supporting such an operation, and this is something that Hersh does not go into in his article. But the third element of the reason that I'm so truly skeptical about his article is that if it was not Assad's forces who used these chemical weapons, then why did Assad agree almost instantaneously, once he was threatened, to give up his what was a very considerable chemical arsenal? I talked, it's interesting, during a conference at the end of last year here in Istanbul with some Iranian ministers. You know, Iran was the victim of chemical attacks by the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. And I said to one of the ministers, "What do you think possessed Assad to do this?" He said, "I don't know, but we got to him very quickly, and we told him to desist." So Iran, which is one of the closest allies of Assad and is supplying manpower, weapons, intelligence, support of every kind, as well as Russia, Syria, you know, the Assad's other major supporters, both together with the U.S. threats, they all got all over Assad after this attack. So I'm telling you, if Assad hadn't done it, I don't think he would have made this concession instantly. And you know, as you know, most of the chemical weapons and the precursors have now been removed. Not all, but most of them.
Roy, earlier you mentioned something that is, again, one of the hallmarks of conflict reporting in our time. In areas like Syria, where it's too dangerous for a Western reporter to try and get to the scene because it's likely to cost life and limb, we as journalists, more and more dependent on social media and video, YouTube video, from the scene, which on the one hand supplies a detail of information that is in many ways unsurpassed, but on the other hand is more susceptible to manipulation and supplies disinformation at the same powerful rate that it supplies information. So as a reporter trying to work a story but work it through the window of the computer screen, how do you deal with the slipperiness of video whose provenance is often very hard to determine?
Well, David, you're asking a profound question, and I wish I had a formula for responding in a snappy way, but I don't. This may be the least and the worst covered war of our time, because the Assad regime has done its very best to exclude the media, and then the ISIS, the Iraqi State of Iraq and Sham, the ISIS has sort of finished the job by threatening journalists who try to enter with you know, unlimited, endless detention and torture. So you know, in theory, we should be relying more on the citizen journalists inside the country who are sending out any number of videos every day and lots of material on Facebook, but we don't. And the reason is the very one you mentioned, that you know, their information has not been vetted, it has not been edited, it has not been double checked, and we know that most of the journalists are affiliated, and this happens in war, as you know very well, with the force that is protecting them, and so they are going to present them in a better light, and everybody else in a lesser light. I have one, so I'll tell you how I do it. I basically try to rely on the social media to verify something that somebody tells me. In other words, I did a story early last year about the systematic attacks by the regime on bakeries and bread lines. I mean, there were something like 100 of them. And in order to, but I had a list first of 150 of them, which I got from Syrian NGOs, you know, humanitarian and human rights NGOs. I just simply checked out every one of them to see whether there was a picture on YouTube or on Twitter or somewhere else or Facebook to back up the assertion that such and such a place had been attacked. And I was able to find in two-thirds of the cases that it was backed up. So I was able to use it as a tool to verify. But the second thing is, I think, frankly, we should all be really questioning ourselves, how can we improve the coverage of Syria? Because the general public does not know what happens on a given day. Where are barrel bombs being dropped? Where are cities being destroyed? Where are people fleeing to camps? How many people are in the camps? And we need this information in order to give a good enough picture for the public. And I have an answer for that, which is to set up some kind of an organization, to set up a news agency that would have international editors, skilled international editors, and citizen journalists, or whomever is inside. It could be Westerners, it could be Syrians. And to do an editing process and a verifying process and a vetting process that is going to produce things, news that internationally known editors can vouch for. I see that as the only answer to finding out what's really happening in Syria. Because I think otherwise, if you depend on me and my colleagues and some of whom are very courageous and have been in there multiple times, the very most you can get from any of us is a tiny sliver of information about one place. And we're missing the big picture. We're missing the overall picture. We're missing the detail of what happens. We're missing the images. It's all going to waste right now.
Roy, we've got only about 2 minutes left. As you say, covering Syria is so dangerous that, for the most part, it's simply not being covered eyes on the ground by outside professional reporters. You yourself were heavily concussed, I believe, in northeastern Syria. Just when you get up in the morning, in the days when you are in Syria, what do you tell yourself about what you're going to do and not do so that you can report again tomorrow? And I don't mean this cavalierly, because it's a real question.
One of the worst things about going into a war zone is thinking about it. before you go somewhere, so much goes through your mind about, have I said goodbye to everybody? Is my flat in order? How can I, what happens if I don't make it back today? And then it turns out
Well, we appear to have suddenly lost our signal from Roy Guttman, and there's confirmation of that. Roy Guttman, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent of the McClatchy Papers. For the past year and a half, he has been in Syria, Turkey, and Jordan, reporting on the Syrian war as best as is possible. As he so eloquently put it, the last thing that you think about before you cross the border going into a war zone is, have I said goodbye to everybody? It's a frightening sort of mantra, but the other half of it is that once you do cross the border, you sort of turn off that part of your consciousness and turn it all onto what you are seeing. To the serious and practical question of keeping yourself alive to report another day. Guttman hopefully will have many more days of Pulitzer Prize-winning quality reporting. We thank him greatly for joining us from Istanbul for his report on the war inside Syria.